There are so many first responders out there that are suffering from depression, PTSD, and everything in between. My next guest, Dr. Robert Perkins, is going to talk about the issues of PTSD and police suicides in the United States. And he is doing a fantastic job of raising the awareness of what needs to be done to change these rising statistics. Stay tuned for the CJ Evolution podcast. Hello, everybody. Welcome back. Patrick here. Thank you for tuning in. Whatever you were doing, wherever you were at, thank you for spending a little bit of your valuable time with me. We continue to grow because of you, the listener and supporter. If you'd rate and review the show on iTunes, we sure would appreciate it. Give us that 5-star rating. Head over to cjevolution.com. You're going to see a link to iTunes. I am so excited to be partnered with Detect-A-Chem. Mobile threat detection is here, folks. This great company is protecting our brave men and women in uniform, whether it's the military or our first responders. Head over to cjevolution.com, click the link to Detect-A-Chem, and they can do amazing things for your organization. Man, I am so excited, super pumped to be on the radio now. Yes, you heard me right. I am on the radio, folks. Specifically, an amazing radio station called WMAP, and that stands for World's Most Amazing People. And you can find me at WMAPradio.com. Check out the shows. It airs every night at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. I get to highlight some of the great and amazing guests I've had on the show, as well as rap and talk with Casey Armstrong, the creator and host of this amazing radio station. Again, head over there. You will not be disappointed. On to the show. Hello, everybody. Welcome back. Talking to Dr. Robert Perkins. Sir, are you there?
I am.
Well, thank you for coming on the show, Robert. I appreciate it. And I'll just get right down to it. Why are officers depressed, and why are they killing themselves?
Well, officers are depressed, and you're seeing a high rate of police suicide as a result of accumulated trauma that they've experienced by over the years and through their career of seeing all of these terrible things that we expect that our police officers respond to, and it doesn't affect them at all. Mm-hmm. And they're human beings like everyone else, and everyone has a sort of bucket with a capacity. And once that bucket kind of reaches its fullness, it begins to overflow. And that's why you see so many police officers that are taking their own lives and just not being able to effectively process that trauma that they've experienced throughout their career.
And what are the numbers, doctor? I mean, I don't know the exact numbers, but I'm sure you do.
The numbers, the easiest way to look at it is a 2-to-1 ratio. Mm-hmm. So if you take the amount of police officers that are killed in the line of duty, so that's from being shot or stabbed or traffic accidents and whatnot, you take that number and you double that. That is consistently the number of officers that commit suicide each year. Suicide is the number one cause of death for police officers in the United States.
It's so scary. And we were talking a little bit off the air about how come, you know, people are not flocking, to law enforcement like they did when I got in the profession over 2 decades ago. Obviously, it's a different world, a lot more scrutiny. You would think that we would teach more about this in the academies, about officer wellness and recognizing PTSD and things like that, but we're still not, right, doctor?
We're not. The awareness is there, and that's great. Mm-hmm. But what we need to do, as well as being aware, is have proactive programs that are going to prevent these things from happening. And right now, a lot of our efforts are focused on sort of a reactive in sort of addressing what the needs of these officers will be that are suffering from PTSD. And I like to call it post-traumatic stress difficulty and not disorder, because it's an actual natural physiological and emotional process that the body goes through when they're exposed to so much stress. It's not a disorder, but we've got that stigma, and the mental health community and the hospitals and doctors, they're grasping at straws because they haven't been able to find something that's really put a dent in taking care of these people.
Yeah, and I see a lot. I've been to a lot of, you know, training and conferences in my years in law enforcement, and the majority of it that I saw was good training, but they address the problem. 80% of it or 85% of it was the problem. Okay, here's the problem. But 15% was, all right, here's some solutions. And I think there needs to be more solutions instead of saying, Well, there's the problem. Well, that's great. Anybody can do that. But what are the solutions? What are we doing?
Exactly. And unfortunately, for the most part, a lot of the there's been limited success in PTSD treatments because they're focusing on symptoms and not the actual root cause. And I'll be quite frank in saying that the number one method of treatment for officers and military veterans that suffer from PTSD is the prescription of pharmaceutical drugs.
Mm-hmm. Which is a horrible cycle. You know that.
It is. And so you're taking people that, you know, many times, especially with military veterans as well and police officers, they're struggling sometimes with a physical injury that's compounded by a psychological injury. And some of the prescription drugs that they're given, I mean, they're taking handfuls of drugs because the drug that they take to, you know, make them relax won't let them sleep. And so they have to take another drug for that. And it goes on and it goes on and it goes on.
Mm-hmm. Now, you talked to just a ton of people out there, thousands of people. And we were talking again a little bit off the air about, you know, there needs to be buy-in from the upper echelons in an organization, right?
That's correct. There needs to be buy-ins from every person that's a stakeholder here.
Sure.
So that's police departments, that's city, that's the general public, that's other nonprofits and community groups. I mean, because this is a large problem. Mm-hmm. And I'm only one person, and my wife and I, who works side by side with me, who's also a psychophysiologist, you know, we spent so much time treating individuals, and we're only two people. And so we had to take some steps to be able to train other individuals that are going to be able to take the skill set that we have and the technology that we've learned to go and help people, because it's we can't keep up with the numbers.
Why do you think there is such a resistance to this? I mean, because we all know about it. We all, like you said, there's an awareness out there, but why isn't there much action behind that? What are your thoughts on that?
Primarily because they don't seem to have a magical solution that's going to end the problem, number one. And number two, they're afraid of the financial implications of acknowledging the fact that police officers that have been exposed to all of this trauma and crisis over the years, they haven't given them any sort of skill set to prevent that from happening, and they'll become liable. And so We look at police officers that suffer from PTSD, they can't get workman's compensation. If a police officer was shot and shot in the leg, we wouldn't expect him to limp to work the next day to go to work. We would recognize the fact that he was injured. He would have some time to recover, or maybe he doesn't come back on the job, and he would be compensated through pensions and workman's compensation. But they don't treat PTSD like that. And PTSD is an injury just like any other injury that's, officers encounter while doing their work.
Yeah.
And yet in the United States, it's less than five states that actually recognize PTSD as a workman's comp injury.
Yeah. I mean, I understand the liability behind it, the financial implications for a municipality or any organization for that matter. But I guess the flip side of that is if you have somebody out there, and you know this, and the listener probably does too, maybe not, if you have somebody out there who is suffering from something, and they're mentally not in the game, but yet they got a gun strapped and they're driving a car and they get into something, well, heck, they could be liable too, because they've been the police department, which ultimately there's vicarious liability, they're going to be the ones held accountable. So it's a double-edged sword. So why not treat it at the beginning so you don't have to worry about that down the road? I just don't understand that.
Exactly. And you just hit the nail on the head. Like, we have between 800 to 900,000 active police officers in the United States. And statistically, we know that between 15 and 20% of those officers that are carrying guns that are going to work every day meet the criteria for a diagnosis of PTSD. Mm. These are active police officers.
Yeah, and it's just, so I just don't get it. I mean, I understand there's a financial liability, but I just don't know. I think we could be doing more to be more proactive. You know, I mean, we're a proactive group of people generally, law enforcement. I just don't know why we're not being more proactive with this, because the human capital, our officers, are the most important asset in an organization. Yeah, there's other people. I'm not trying to say other people don't matter. I'm just saying those are the people on the front line, right?
Absolutely. And if they say it's too expensive, well, then what is the price of the life of a police officer?
Exactly. Exactly. Now,
and it will be the numbers that cause change. And if you look at really where PTSD was even recognized by the mental health community, it wasn't until after Vietnam and when some of the statistics, and we know that approximately 58,000 Americans died in combat in Vietnam, but by 1986, of the veterans that returned home, 117,000 veterans committed suicide by 1986. And by 1991, that jumped to 152,000. Mm-hmm. So PTSD claimed the lives of more Vietnam veterans than actual combat did.
Mm-hmm. Now, to talk about, if you would, Robert, talk about the foundation, the GCISF.
Yes, the Global Critical Incident Stress Foundation. And what our mandate is to train people as what we call certified critical incident stress debriefers. And the best way to understand what that skill is it's kind of like mental first aid. So when someone, an officer or an emergency services person, has been exposed to trauma, there is a criteria that's set that after 24 hours, they're sit down and they're taken through a protocol which gets them to sort of talk about the incident that they experienced, how they felt, what they were thinking. And statistically, we know that when these people are debriefed after trauma, statistically between about 70 and 80% of those people will not develop post-traumatic stress difficulty or an operational stress injury. Whereas if they didn't go through that, they could just repress the trauma and think, okay, I've dealt with it, it's done, and mm-hmm. I don't have to think about it again.
Mm-hmm. Now, what makes this, because there's other organizations out there and foundations out there, what makes the GCISF different from other organizations out there?
Well, two primary reasons. First of all, we are in the business of helping people. We're not in business. Mm-hmm. And last year, in the training that I conducted all over Canada and the United States, we gave away more training in scholarships than we collected in sort of course fees. Because I will never turn down a person that really wants to help somebody else, but they don't have the sort of financial to be able to take a particular course. So that's number one. And the second thing is that we have access to technology that's just recently been developed that has an extremely high rate of eliminating physiological PTSD symptoms permanently. We're talking mm-hmm. about a 98% rate that doesn't involve any long therapy or medications or anything like that. So those two things sort of integrated into our training. It was started actually in Canada, and it just sort of grew, and it's come through Canada and the United States.
Yeah.
And now we're expanding actually into Australia, Thailand, the Philippines.
That is amazing. And I like what you say on the website, and it's GCISF.org. We don't teach just stress management. We teach the science behind healthy mental control. Can you talk a little bit about that?
For sure. There are many programs out there that they mean well, but they're really their band-aid solutions. And what we are about is giving people core skills that is going to give them the solution to have management back of their life. And a very good definition of PTSD is when a person loses mastery of their life. They can't function as a normal person, not in the workplace, not in their home or their families. And so the technology that we utilize in this gives them the ability to get their lives back.
Mm-hmm. Now, how important, Robert, kind of along the same lines of what you just were talking about, I'm a big mindfulness person. If you would ask me like a handful of years ago about mindfulness, I meditate now, and it has really changed my life. I mean, what are your thoughts on that when it comes to like stress management and things like that?
You're scratching the surface of what the core cure to this is, mm-hmm. and it all comes down to breathing. Mm-hmm. And you know, many people, you know, for centuries in all kinds of both Eastern and Western things, they'll say, "Oh, just breathe, relax, just breathe," but they don't go into scientifically. Well, why is it that breathing is successful in sort of taking a person that's extremely upset or hyperactive and bringing them to normal? And what our organization does is we teach exactly the scientific technology, and we explain how the body responds and why breathing is successful. And it's successful because when people are suffering from PTSD symptoms, they are doing something with their body, which is bringing in approximately 30 to 40% less oxygen mm-hmm. into the body. And that is setting off alarms. It's setting off alarms with the brain because that upsets the homeostasis and the pH level of the body. It doesn't give our heart and lungs or our blood enough oxygen. And so the brain says, hey, this can't go on. If this goes on for a long period of time, this could cause grievous bodily harm to the body or death. And so the body needs to get your attention. And so what the brain does is it releases into the bloodstream this cocktail of all of these chemicals consisting of adrenaline, and dopamine, and epinephrine. And it creates, you know, rapid heart rate. And, you know, people, they think they're having panic attacks. But this is a utilitarian function that the body has to protect us.
Yeah.
So when people get involved in mindfulness, when people get involved in yoga or meditation, one of the primary directives of that is breathing. And when we're breathing properly and we're increasing and maintaining the levels of oxygen that our body needs, that's why they find these techniques so successful.
Yeah. And I love it because, I mean, I've been meditating for the last 5 years. And again, it's changed my life. And I also think, and you tell me if I'm wrong, you know, law enforcement is an inherently toxic environment. You know, I mean, we deal with people or we handle calls when people are not at their best, but internally it can be a toxic environment too. How important is it, Robert, to kind of, you know, surround yourself with people who are positive, upbeat, who have an, you know, upbeat vision or of life? I mean, I know it's hard in a law enforcement organization sometimes, but I really do believe that can affect you a lot too.
For sure. And it's the subculture of policing. Mm-hmm. I mean, there used to be this saying, whereas if you can't count on one hand more than five friends that aren't police officers, that you could be putting yourself in a problematic situation.
Yeah.
The problem is policing is not just a job. It is a culture.
Sure.
It is our occupation. It is our social outlet. And generally when police officers are socializing with other police officers, they're talking about police stuff. And so this becomes our life. And that's a great bond, just like in the military. But
sure,
a lot of the things that we're going to be talking about are all of these sort of toxic and crisis and trauma that we've experienced. So we're almost re-experiencing the trauma all of the time.
But doesn't there have to be, you never really turn it off. But shouldn't you, when you're gone, shouldn't you focus on other things? I know it's difficult, but shouldn't you just come home? Because I was that guy years ago where I'd come home and I had a bad day at work. I was ticked off. I was mad. My family, my relationship suffered. So I guess what advice would you give people out there who are going through this right now with stress, how to turn it off or at least kind of focus on other things?
It requires discipline.
Sure.
You know, police officers aren't immune to the sight of blood or to these emotional feelings of the bad things that they have to see in their careers. But what they've developed is the ability to suppress those emotions. And what a lot of police officers find is it's really easy to maintain that 24/7. But it doesn't work very well when you start integrating that into family relationships.
Mm-hmm.
And so the key is discipline. And I remember when I was in law enforcement going to a Caliber Press street survival seminar.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that they were telling us was the importance of, you know, that mentally, you know, as I'm putting my uniform on with each piece of equipment and my body armor and my uniform, then I become sort of that person. And then at the end of my shift, mentally training myself that as I take each piece of my uniform and equipment off, I'm slowly sort of leaving that sort of person and becoming the sort of non-law enforcement person.
Mm-hmm.
And it's difficult because, you know, it's a fun thing. It's always adrenaline packed and, you know, we want to maintain this bravado, and especially if we're socializing with other police officers, and we maintain that sort of attitude almost 24/7. But the true police officer that wants balance will have to learn how to discipline himself mentally to take him out of that mindset when the job is finished for the day.
And it is such a different world that we police in now, Robert. You know that, at least it is. I mean, that's my opinion. I mean, we're under so much more scrutiny these days. You know, it just seems like there's more of an anti-police sentiment out there than ever before. I think there's always been one, but I mean, and it's, but I like to think, and maybe I'm just naive, that there's a ton of police support out there. I wish that it was more vocal, but geez, I mean, I don't know. Why would anybody want to get into law enforcement today? I mean, it's beyond me, and God bless the people who do. But it is unbelievable out there now with all the bad media and press and all these groups that hate the cops.
It is. It's a different breed of police officer that's sort of coming to the forefront now. I mean, I look back in the day when I was in law enforcement, you know, to be a cop back then, you had to be a big guy and have a clean record,
you know,
because that's what they wanted. And now we're looking for that more educated police officer, that we're looking for that police officer that has sort of that desire and sort of sensitivity. But at the same time, we're exposing them to levels of accountability that no one ever thought was possible. And when people have asked, well, what's the hardest thing about being a police officer? What's the most dangerous thing? It's not the perils that we encounter in the job. It's the fact that I might have 3 seconds to make a life-changing decision that could affect my life, the life of a suspect or a life of the person in the community. Mm-hmm. And then afterwards, having to be accountable to my peers or to senior management or senior command and explain why I did that in the 3 seconds I had to decide. Mm-hmm. And so that is the hardest part. That is accountability, and that is stress beyond anything that you'll ever encounter in the street.
You're doing so much for law enforcement around the country, and I thank you for that. Now, are you seeing a difference? I mean, how do you measure whether or not you're being effective or not, Robert?
Well, I would like to say that I would measure that by the number of people, organizations, and police agencies that are starting to buy into this training, which is greater. We have collaborated with some very major nonprofit, specifically in California. We have the Love Anaheim, Love Our Cities program, and they're so into this that within the Love Anaheim nonprofit, they created 2 entities. One where we're just taking people from the community that care, training them as certified critical incident stress debriefers, as well as they created a chaplain program to be able to respond to the needs of people who are in trauma and crisis. Mm-hmm. Peacekeepers for Life with Mike Zanito, who's just become a board member with my organization, as well as Badge of Life in Canada, Code 9 Officer Needs Assistance. So all of these people, we're getting together and we're saying, listen, you know, these are valuable skills. They're life-saving skills. And the more that it gets out to the general public, the more that we're going to have effect. But at the end of the day, the effect will be in a decrease of police suicides and things of that nature.
Do you think, what are some of the challenges do you think that law enforcement, I mean, internally we've talked about some of the challenges, you know, taking care of our officers better, and I hope we do that through organizations like yours. But what do you think some external challenges are for organizations in the future?
Resistant to change would be the first. Mm-hmm. I mean, even police departments that sort of embrace the concept of critical incident stress debriefing, you know, something really bad would happen and they'd say, okay, we need a debriefing, and they'd use an outside party, either a psychologist or a psychiatrist or an organization from the outside to come in and do the debriefing. Mm-hmm. And you and I both know that there's the police subculture doesn't necessarily welcome outsiders, and we're not going to be sharing how we really feel or how we really think to these people for fear of how we're going to be interpreted, or we just don't trust them. Mm-hmm. And so the model that I'm teaching is having frontline people. So that's frontline officers, that's sergeants, that's dispatchers, part of the actual peer group to be the ones that are doing these debriefings. And there's a lot more opportunity for men and women to be honest and for it to be more effective than this was being done by someone who's on the outside of the blue wall.
Now, don't you think, I mean, couldn't that go the opposite direction too, Doctor, where, you know, somebody internally, you know, I mean, I guess there's pros and cons to it, but somebody internally, yeah, you know this person, you're a fellow officer and you've worked together for a long time maybe, and don't you think there's a fear of, okay, exposing myself to this person, especially a supervisor? I don't want them to think I'm weak, or you know what I mean? Maybe can you run the risk of the opposite one? Go ahead.
The model that we use is successful because generally when it's peer driven, it's sort of on the same, you're not having a supervisor as the person that's conducting the debriefing. But in the first step of our debriefing, if someone who's being debriefed does not want someone in the room, i.e., you know, a sergeant or somebody else, then they have the right to say, I don't want this person here, and that person has to leave. You know, it's created as such to create that we want comfort. If it's not going to be done properly and officers are not going to respond, then what's the point of having it?
Sure.
But there is a science to this, and it works.
I wish there was organizations like yours. When I was a younger officer, I remember getting into critical incidents, and you know what they said? All right, it's done. Do your report. Get back on the street.
Yeah, that's it. Suck it up, Buttercup. I mean, that was the sort of phrases that were used. It's part of the job. Get used to it, you know. But at least we're starting to get in a sense of awareness where that's not our first response. Well, that's great, but we need to have an infrastructure, and we need to have programs to prevent things from happening, and resources to officers to kind of help them deal with it. And one of the demographics of people that are getting missed in here are the retired officers. Mm-hmm. I mean, officers can go their entire life. They can put 20 years in. They've seen everything. They've done everything. They've never had a symptom of any sort of PTSD or stress. And then all of a sudden, for the first time in their life, they get all this spare time. And as they're out there fishing, then their slide projector starts, and they start sort of seeing all of the things that they dealt with, and they're starting to get physiological symptoms. They've never felt that in their life.
Yeah.
And they'll gravitate to alcohol or drugs because they want to stop that. And they think they're broken. The biggest message I want to give people is, listen, we're human beings. When you feel that way, you're not broken. It's a normal reaction mm-hmm. to an abnormal set of circumstances.
Yeah, I love it. And I wish we were talking again a little bit off the air. They need to be teaching this more in academies, Doctor. And I know curriculums are jam-packed. I get it. But we need to be doing a lot more about this on the front end. Not that it you might still have the same problem. You probably will. But we need to be educating officers on the front end of their careers instead of dealing with this in the middle and at the tail end of their careers.
Yes, correct. And the problem is there is very little curriculum that sort of meets the mandates of the police academies. I've talked to some police academies and training organizations, and they're saying, okay, you know what? You can have an hour and a half. We can insert an hour and a half into our curriculum, and an hour and a half, it's not an appropriate amount of time. And we're talking about a life-saving skill. So, you know, we certainly wouldn't cut hours to teach our officers how to perform first aid or CPR. We're not going to cut hours on self-defense. We're not going to cut hours on firearms training, because there needs to be a level of proficiency with the knowledge that's being given to the officers. And that needs to be in place for finding effective ways to deal with the post-traumatic stress, operational stress, and the resources of what to do when officers find themselves in that situation.
Now, if people want to reach out to you, Robert, and your organization, how can they find you?
Well, they can find us on the web. Our website is www.gcisf.org, or any of our associated, we have restoredheroes.com, which focuses primarily on military veterans that are suffering from PTSD, as well as any of the other charities, and our partners are listed on that website.
Well, Dr. Robert Perkins, thank you so much, sir, for coming on the show and talking about the foundation, and we'll have that linked up in the show notes. Much success to you and your organization. Thank you for what you're doing. Much needed within the law enforcement criminal justice community. If we could ever be of help, please reach out to me. Is there any final words you would like to give the listener?
What I would like to say is that someone who is struggling with these issues, they're not broken, they're normal, and there is help available. Reach out for resources if you need help. Our website is there. Email us, call us, and we will get you in touch with that resource and throw you the life preserver that you may so desperately need.
And Dr. Robert Perkins, thank you so much, sir. Much success to you in the future.
Thank you, Patrick. It's a pleasure being here.
All right. Take care. Such an honor talking to Dr. Robert Perkins. And like he said, that there are plenty of resources out there. If you are suffering, please reach out, ask for help. You do not have to suffer alone, folks. I hope you enjoyed this very informative and very important podcast. Stay tuned for more great guests on the CJ Evolution podcast.